You are listening to Inside the Coffin.
Please note, at times, witnessing the dead can be distressing and disturbing. This podcast is not appropriate for children.
You are going to die.
We are going to die.
We are all in the process of dying. Everything and everyone.
At all times. Your mother, old trees, every single antelope, your beloved pet, Tom Cruise, the girl you were in love with in high school, everyone you've ever feared or revered. What was present becomes the past. The things you love dearly become cringe. What was eaten becomes shit. What was published becomes buried, left to rot.
Death is an endless cycle in indie publishing. Magazines pop up and die, rendered defunct. Stories go live, are clicked on and swallowed by a tiny crowd, admired and then generally forgotten. How many indie stories from 10 years ago have you read recently? It's fine to say none, yet people spend months gestating something, nurturing something for it to reach an audience of a few hundred people and then be buried in the dirt of the ether. These magazines spurt out from wounds of passion, made by people with full-time jobs and struggles in the land of the living. They don't ever make any money, at least Witchcraft magazine never has.
Across 9 years, 250,000 website clicks and nearly 2,000 physical copies sold, the magazine has stood, stumbled, and respirated. This life has not been effortless. There have always been obstacles and moments where total death has felt imminent, where it has seemed another issue of the magazine will not be birthed, released to its inevitable death.
We know the effort, the long nights, the strain of emails, of editing, of printing. We know how it feels to do a full-time job on top of a full-time job. We know that in the grand scheme of the universe, our impact is next to none. Yet it is still an impact. It still means something to some people. Inevitably, some primal urge manifests. Another issue is printed. Blood, sweat, and tears are sacrificed in the name of the void.
Is it self-important to believe that small magazines are important? Is it wrong to revive what the world has laid to rest?
We must respect the dead, learn their names, and listen to their stories.
It is our responsibility and pleasure as the dying. 8 issues of Witchcraft magazine have deceased since 2015. They remain as a graveyard of stories, poems, essays, artworks, and interviews. On this podcast, we will disinter a selection of coffins from all 8 issues. We will lay their bloated corpses out on the operating table and flood them with electricity. We will give them voice. We will reanimate them and honor them. Then we will lay them gently to rest in open graves.
The stories and poems you are about to hear were originally published in previous issues of Witchcraft magazine. Today, they will be read by
Genevieve Jagger
and Julia Fisher, the latent spawn of Witchcraft magazine. In some circumstances, we have raised the dead to speak for themselves, to comment on the fact of their own deadness. We perform such a tasteless act both to give you something to listen to on your journey down the River Styx, but also to acknowledge where life was once present. We are attempting a Frankenstein experiment to ensure our monsters are duly remembered.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to witness the reanimation of August Smith's Calibration, originally published in issue 5 of Witchcraft magazine. August Smith is an artist in Austin, Texas. He makes poems, songs, and games, and has a website at augustsmith.net. His social media handles are at August J. Smith on all relevant platforms. And his current projects include working on a UFO book called Visitors from the Red Star, and recording music under the name plum wooer.
Calibration. Author's note. Because poetry is not only a communicative medium, but also a shared, experiential, virtualized space complicatedly transcending traditional modes of time and location, the poet and the reader must calibrate to one another's imaginative spheres before proceeding, like two cellos tuning to the same note before a performance, or like in a heist movie when the protagonists synchronize their watches before they drive a small European car into the side of a bank. For this purpose, the following poem serves as a calibration exercise between poet and recipient. Please follow the instructions in each step to ensure a stable, synchronistic calibration. Thank you and enjoy. Please take a deep breath. Imagine a version of me standing in front of you, holding up my fist. Focus your gaze on my fist. Follow the fist with your eyes. Do not look away. Do not look at me. Nothing exists besides my fist. Consider the fist. Accept the fist as the subject of your consideration. Consider the fist considering you. Now watch as I slowly rotate my fist. Think about how it feels for me to be rotating my fist. Think about the last time you thought about a fist. Now, focus on my knuckles. Consider their symbolic content as weapons, as instruments. Consider their linguistic content. Knuckle rhyming with buckle, which rhymes with chuckle, which rhymes with fuckle. Do not let the made-up word fuckle throw you off. Let it exist alongside the other real words. Let them all hang out and be chill. Wonder at the history of the word knuckle, how it comes from Proto-Germanic and Middle Dutch, from the word for little bone, how it's linked to the word knot and knob. In the periphery of your mind, let the phrase knuckle duster float around, with knuckle down and knuck if you buck. Ask yourself, what's the opposite of a knuckle? Allow these thoughts to flow around inside your head like liquids of various densities. Let them combine and intertwine and absorb one another. Bend them around any obstacles like logic or self-consciousness. Don't feel stupid, but don't feel smart either. The calibration is 50% complete. Return your focus to the fist. The fist will now transform. Stay focused on it. Picture the fist transforming into the head of an alligator. Picture it in disgusting, excruciating detail. How incredible. The alligator. She looks calm, rested, confident. She has witnessed great bloodshed, but has experienced great love. She looks ready to speak. You must imagine the alligator's voice as the voice of your birth mother. If you're unable to do that, substitute in any other matronly voice from your life or media. The alligator says, knuckle. You didn't imagine it sufficiently, I can tell. Let's try again. In the voice of your mother, the alligator says, knuckle. 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 The alligator is transforming again. Stick with it. We're nearly calibrated. Now it's a sapphire glimmering in the air, balanced on the end of my wrist. The sapphire is hatching like an egg. Picture that. Picture the little pieces falling off, the slight tapping sound the pieces make as they hit the ground. Out of the sapphire egg emerges, what? An eyeball, of course. It's looking all over, this way and that, nervously. It's looking down at my shoes. Now, look down at my shoes. If you can't see them, imagine my shoes. I will tell you they are black and comfortable. They are hatching like a pair of eggs. Do not picture anything emerging from the shoes. Do not picture anything emerging from the shoes. Let them crumble. Look back up at the eyeball. Notice how it has become a helicopter. There's a tiny man in the helicopter. Say hello to him. Think about his life. Why is he so sad? Is the helicopter making him sad? We don't know, can only infer the connections between these objects, infinite in their possibility. The helicopter floats like a dragonfly over a lake of fire. You can feel the warmth. We are very nearly calibrated. A rope ladder rolls down from the helicopter like a vine. The man emerges and slides down. He is small, wearing nice chinos, a little top hat. He's cute. He drops. Let him drop into the flames. Okay. We have all murdered a man and are bound by his bloodshed, and the calibration is nearly complete. Back to the helicopter, slowly morphing back into a closed fist? No, into a butterfly. It flutters away into a golden sky. Goodbye, butterfly. Wow. Calibration complete. Let's check those numbers. Emotional resonance factor is at 100%. Symbolic paradigm reactor is at 100%. Linguistic centers loosened. Logic reaction mechanisms temporarily disabled. And semantic pliability is at maximum level. Cool. Perfect calibration. All we had to do was kill that guy.
Thank you, August. Such a shame that we had to kill that man. But we admit it was very satisfying. We now hear again from August in his eulogy to calibration. Please be seated and hold a somber expression as a sign of respect for his mourning.
Today we lay to rest Calibration. Calibration was written in 2016 or 17 or something like that and was published in the Witchcraft Mag's fifth issue. And I wrote this poem at a time in my life when I was doing a lot of readings. So it was at the end of my time in grad school and the reading invitations were flowing in and I was really involved in a lot of the literature stuff happening in Boston at the time. So I was writing a lot of poems that cater specifically to the reading atmosphere. There's a very theatrical element to the way this poem is performed. When I read this poem, I'm obviously holding up my fist. I'm transforming it into an alligator. I'm transforming it into a helicopter, a butterfly, etc., through various hand motions. So I was wondering if I could get this poem published because I wondered if it would work the same on the page as it does on the stage. I was happy that the editors of Witchcraft Mag were into it and thought it worked. I think this poem was inspired by mecha anime and sort of like a sci-fi trope where a pilot of a big robot has to sort of synchronize their brain waves or something. Like something maybe you've seen Neon Genesis. I think there are scenes like this where the pilots of giant robots have to synchronize with the robot before they are able to control it. And there's usually some sort of sci-fi-esque trope where there's somebody in a command center being like, brainwaves locked in, synchronized at 100%. We got this at 100%. Perfect synchronization. We're good to go. So you can kind of get that flavor at the end of the poem. And I think it really just was inspired by that particular specific trope. There's a couple memories I have of this poem. One of them was reading this poem in 2017 or 18 at my first reading in Austin, Texas, where I live now. I think it was at the house that I lived at on Chestnut Avenue. And my friend's girlfriend, now wife, told me after that reading that that poem helped her understand poetry in a new way. And I thought that was very touching and something that I carry with me. I can understand it, I suppose, not to sound too egotistical, but I can understand it because there's a sort of meta element to the poem. It's a poem about poetry in ways, though through this sort of lens of technology or something. So good job, Calibration. You were a good poem. You lived a long, beautiful life. You made some people laugh, hopefully, and I'm proud of you, and maybe one day I will resuscitate you. I will bring your corpse out of its burial, out of its entombment, and you will maybe be the opening poem to some future book that I publish of all the poems that I have sitting around and have never put anywhere else. So thank you to Witchcraft Mag, to the editors there who accepted this goofy little experiment, and may Calibration, rest in peace. You know, it's hard to say goodbye, but all things die, and you're calibrating with God now, man. Thank you.
Witchcraft Magazine was born in 2015, the love child of authors L. Nash and Catch Business. It first found life like a set of conjoined twins. Catch took front of a small press, Sad Spell, with the mission of making chapbooks, and L. managed the magazine side of things. Setting out, they aimed to publish 2 issues per year, yet the pace of this work proved impossible.
Indeed, it has taken us over a year to create and complete this podcast. Motivation and enthusiasm are deceptive. They cannot reduce a task to nothing. Every simple step has seemed small on the horizon, and then mountainous up close. But we are here, sitting in your ears. 8 issues of the magazine are out in the world. These things are possible, if corporeal.
In 2017, Elle and Catch parted ways to commit to either side of their projects. Catch took the small press, Sad Spell, which by that point had published a novel, a short story collection, 5 chapbooks, and 2 poetry collections. Elle took on the magazine alone, and would later call in the help of other artists and creatives to bear its mighty weight. Nothing exists in isolation. There have been a myriad of writers, artists, editors, readers, and photographers who have all laid their hand upon the magazine, each leaving an indelible mark, making it in some way their own.
We hope that you will make this podcast your own in the act of experiencing it. How will these vibrations warp in the journey from your ear canals to your brain? What kind of meaning will be lost? What will be added?
The first stage of human decomposition is called autolysis. The membranes of cells release enzymes that begin eating the body from the inside out. Self-digestion.
G. Gilbert is a working-class poet and shapeshifter taking up space in southern Maine. They studied writing at the Pratt Institute when this piece was written. They are currently active within the Portland Poet Society, reading and performing monthly and contributing to a growing creative community, as well as working on an untitled and unfinished poetic epic. You can find them at gabrielle.ferragamo.g on Instagram, or at gabriellegill__ on Twitter, or follow the Portland Poet Society on Instagram for updates, readings, submissions, and such. All of these will be linked in the description of this podcast.
The following story originally appeared in issue 2 of Witchcraft magazine. Rots by G. Gilbert. 1. Mickey Rots has 9 fingers and 9 wives. He cut his right pinky finger off when he was 27. We were married at 18 and divorced the same year. Then he met Esther, Clarice, Patty, Laura, Pam, Rosemary, Haley, and April. He has a ring with each of their birthstones on all of his fingers, even mine. Mickey Rots was born Breech one morning in December, and I was born later the same day. Our mothers never met, but they could hear each other screaming. Growing up in Arizona, Mickey would tell me that we were the same Sagittarius star children. He'd say that we were destined to be together. I never questioned him. Mickey Rots believed he was the Holy Spirit incarnate. He dropped out of high school when he was 16 and lived in my basement, eating mushrooms and writing scripture. He'd never let me read it. He would say, "Little Maggie, these are not to be read, but tasted through the skin, like catfish." 2. In the beginning, my parents spoke in apologies until they said nothing at all. I would come home to grunts of acknowledgement. The milk would sour and the fruit would rot, and the next day I would run out to the deli across the street and replace it, or time would reverse and they could eat again. When Mickey moved in, they stuttered understanding and turned away from him when he walked around the house. I'd shower in the morning, and I would hear the creak of the door as they opened it in tandem. "Sorry, honey," they'd say, "sorry." Their conjoined presence was one I could feel under my skin. I had whined at them for years, from behind the transparent shower curtain, pleading with them to stop. They tried to be more discreet about it, popping their heads in for a second to catch my shadow on the wet tiles, going slowly through the motions. They had a son once. I replaced him, my eternal baby brother. I overheard them talking about him once or twice. Miles. He was only a few months old when his tiny lungs filled with bath water, and they'd found him. The carpet had flooded in the hallway, but they never got around to replacing it. Between my bedroom and the living room, in front of the bathroom door, was a 3-foot patch of concrete, stained and cold, between thick edges of ivory carpeting. He died on Labor Day. It was on my 9th Labor Day that I met Mickey. I didn't know what that meant yet. My parents and I walked to the cemetery together, but they broke off when we reached Miles' headstone. They squeezed each other's hands purple and apologized. I stood behind them and cried, but didn't understand. My hands were never purple. I wasn't sorry. I remember staring at my parents' backs and watching them blur together. I looked down at my black shoes and my gut turned. I walked away from them, headed towards the wrought iron entrance gate. There was a boy across the street. He was sitting on the front steps of a beige house, the pointed roof of which ran all the way down the side. I glanced over my shoulder at where my parents were. My mother's head was tucked into my father's neck. Their dark hair looked grown together, like tree roots, grounding them before that headstone, until someone came and cut them down. I crossed the street. When I stood in front of him, on the edge of his property, I questioned what I had come for. I opened my mouth to speak, but said nothing. He smiled at me. His cheeks stretched all the way up to his eyes. 3. I met Mickey again when we were 15. My best friend at the time, Esther, threw a party. Ruckus and illicit behavior ensued. I showed up late. I met Esther in the kitchen, poured myself too much gin, and tried to talk intelligently with unintelligent people. I danced and enjoyed myself, against my better judgment, and at some point ran out the back door to puke over the porch railing. There was someone sitting by my feet. His face was lit up by the kind fluorescent lights of the pool. Swallowing whatever was crawling up my throat, I sat down on the stairs next to him. He had blonde hair, held a tangerine sucked dry, and was smoking his cigarette wrong. "I'm sorry," I said. He looked over at me and smiled so wide I could see his molars. "This is familiar," I said. My stomach was calming down, but the slight ripples in the pool made me dizzy. I rested my elbows on my knees and took a deep breath. He rubbed my back, tentatively trying to calm me. "It's okay, little Maggie," he said. It took a moment, but I remembered him. I remembered the triangle house and my scuffed shoes and the little boy on the porch. "Mickey Rotz, right?" I asked. "We have the same birthday." "Yeah, exactly." "Shit, where have you been?"
"Where you haven't."
"Yeah," I said, laughing.
"You know you're not doing that right," I said, weakly nodding toward the cigarette in his hand. He looked at me and at it and at me again, confused. "The cigarette, the smoking, you have to inhale it, like, all the way. Into your lungs?"
I poked his chest where his lungs would be and hit ribs. I could tell he was embarrassed. I asked him to give me a cigarette and he did, so silently. I lit it, took his hand, placed it over my ribs, and inhaled. I doubt he felt anything except a few bones, but he figured it out.
"This is Esther's place, right?" he asked.
"Oh yeah, it is," I replied. "She's great." I stood up, leaning on the railing for support, and took my shoes off. I dipped a foot in the water and quickly lost balance.
"Careful," he mumbled.
"I'm good, 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 good," I said, walking to the edge of the pool. I looked at him over my shoulder and motioned towards the water.
"You wanna?"
"What?
Swim, can we?
We can do anything."
We took off all we were wearing and slipped into the pool. He kept a respectable distance for a while, and I splashed water at him to try to convince him otherwise. We got out when we heard the party start to die down, fearful of someone walking out and misinterpreting what happened. We were soaked, but we put our clothes on right away. Our hair dripped and our lips turned purple. Stars bloomed. I didn't say goodbye to anyone when I left Esther's. Not even Mickey. The gin was gone, my clothes were wet, and I already had a headache. I started walking towards the direction of my house, only a few minutes away. All the lights were off when I got there. I opened the door wide enough to fit myself through, locked it behind me and kicked my shoes off. I felt along the right wall of the hallway to try and orient myself. The cold concrete in front of the bathroom door came up quicker than I anticipated, but I knew my room was across the way. The nights had just gotten colder and my wet clothes weren't helping. I changed and got into bed. I forgot to brush my teeth. I forgot to floss. I had just gotten comfortable when I heard a tap on the window beside my bed, but I ignored it. Then I heard it again and again. It was Mickey. He had followed me from Esther's. It was romantic at the time. He smiled when I opened the window, as wide as before. "Mickey Rotz, what are you doing here?" He didn't say anything for a little while, which made it feel like a long while. I had considered shutting my window, going back to sleep, convincing myself it was a hallucination. "I'm gonna marry you, Maggie," he said, above a whisper, still smiling. 4. He would often wait at the top of the basement stairs for me after school. My parents knew he was there, but I guess he didn't feel comfortable being alone with them, having never gotten along with his own parents. I made a habit out of spending more time in my basement with him than in my own room. More often than not, he'd play The Doors real low while we talked, or The Cure while we painted and made jewellery, or The White Stripes, just when we were angry. We'd lay on his mattress on the floor, arms around torsos and heads on stomachs and legs tied together. It never stopped being difficult to get him to talk. You could look at him and just know there was energy in there, alive and dangerous, like solar flares. We'd drink or do shrooms, plan the rest of our lives together, dissociate to the point of becoming each other. We fucked down there too. It was nicer than it sounds. One morning, I woke up to him tapping my bottom lip. He said every sound I made tasted like Thanksgiving. My questions were like cranberry sauce, and my whispers like potatoes and gravy. When I kissed him, he said, "Red wine." When I told him I loved him, he would lick his lips and say, "Stuffing." When I screamed, that was the feast. The whole bird cut down the middle and falling onto his plate. He brushed his fingers over my eyes and closed them, saying, "Thank you." He had a rosary that he always wore. It gathered around him in his sleep. His desk was always covered with trash, pages of library books he tore out, coffee cups with less than a sip at the bottom, tin foil with bits of cheese and peppers still stuck to it, empty packets of American spirits, broken chains from necklaces. A pair of my underwear hung from the back of his chair. The only thing he kept in the drawers of his desk and away from me was his book. I wish I had tried to flip through it, at least once when he wasn't looking. Maybe I would have understood. In the middle of the desk, he kept the body of a dead bat we had found. The second half of the body had already lost a lot of fur and skin, but the little face was very much intact, closed jaw and closed eyes, wings stiff and open. If you were to touch it, the fur would come off in patches. One day, my mother went down to the basement when I was at school. Mickey was high, sucking on tangerines and trying to string beads onto the tiny gold chains he had stolen from her room. That she hadn't noticed. Mickey hadn't heard her come downstairs, that is, until she screamed. Her eyes glued to the little bat on the desk and retreated back upstairs, tripping and hasty. I remember coming home to see her leaning over the kitchen sink, drinking glass after glass of water. Mickey laughed when I told him. "Oh, yeah, well, she has a thing about dead bodies," I said. "Most do." "True." I leaned against the desk and looked down at the hem of my sweater, burnt from the dryer and fraying. "Hey, have I ever told you about Miles?" "No." I explained all I knew about my brother. It was the first time I had told anyone about him. Mickey's reaction was that of revelation. His eyes were sympathetic, but savage. He held my hand and apologized for my loss, struggling to hold back a smile. He kissed me and said, "Thank you." 5. As we had hoped, no one came to our wedding. It was our birthday. Mickey gave me a ring that morning when I came home with gas station coffee and bagels and insisted that we do this and we do it today. He said it was a gift for both of us. I took my mother's wedding dress from her closet and met Mickey on the side of the highway next to the cemetery where my brother was buried. There, we sat, It was quiet, the kind of quiet that filled you up, leaving no room for questions or doubt. He held my hands and I prayed to him, head bowed over our laps and eyes closed like they teach you in seminary school. I didn't need to hear his vows. I had seen them, tasted them. He was verbal through movements, like the creaking steps of the basement, the scratch of his pencil on paper in that big book, his wild laughter. The wine was bitter. It was a hobby of ours at the time, making wine. We'd bought a kiddie pool and poured grapes and blackberries in it. We poured it in old mason jars and let it sit in a small refrigerator in the basement for almost 6 weeks. We didn't spend much time peeling the grapes, anxious to stick our feet in and feel it squish between our toes, and the smaller blackberries were still whole, sinking to the bottom of the jars. This seemed like the perfect occasion to taste what we had made. We kissed with purple lips and held each other's hands, not like we had lost something, but like we had been found. We took our sacrament, Benzedrine tablets, and we sucked on tangerines to make it go down quicker. Mickey never looked calm when he took benzos. His whole face seemed to twist around his bone structure, like his skin was saltwater taffy falling off of a taffy puller. I was the opposite. It felt as if my skin was stuck to my bones, like static, craving an impossible closeness within my body and outside of it. I crawled onto Mickey's lap as the sun retreated from view. I closed my eyes, nostalgic for the quickly receding present. He let me lay like that for a while. Then he started to laugh, through the nose at first, until he couldn't hold it in anymore and shook me awake. "Mags," he said. I could hear the smile in his voice. "Maggie, look, you gotta see this." Eyes lazy and muscles stiff, I followed his gaze over my shoulder and across the street to where we met the first time, on the porch of his parents' triangle house. I saw no porch, just flames. Fire spit out of the windows and slid up the roof. The porch was caving in on itself in blazing chunks of wood. I sat up. "Mickey, what happened?" I asked, sitting up away from him. "What did you do?" "I visited them while you were getting the dress." "What? I don't understand. Where are your parents?" "In there somewhere." "What?" I stood up fully. My muscles cracked and I stumbled over the train of my dress, dirtied by sand and some spilt wine. I couldn't focus on anger or fear. No emotion stuck around long enough for me to express it. He looked at me and back at his childhood home. He smiled, a small, strange smile. "I haven't had parents for a long time now, little Maggie. This was for the best. They were just lingering around anyway. They did their job, and now I have to do mine," he said with a shrug. "What's your job?" I asked anxiously. He didn't answer. "Mickey?" He didn't look at me. "Mickey, what's my job?" The wind picked up slightly and blew his curls gently around his face. "I don't know yet," he said. "But I know you're supposed to be here with me." He held his hand out to me. The ring I slid on his finger less than an hour ago reflected light. I held his fingers weakly, bent down onto the sand again, and leaned against his chest. I didn't know how to feel or what to think. I didn't know anything except him. I watched as the house was reduced to ash, landing soft onto the scorched ground. I buried the urge to get up and look for the bodies of Mickey's parents. I buried it so far that I only now remember that they were really in there.
We now present to you a eulogy written by author G. Gilbert, as read by Julia Fisher.
A eulogy for a desert born from lost New York nights, for dorm rooms and darkness and spite. I once was writing a story of love and watched it twist and burn into something dangerous. Unfinished on the pyre sits Rots on page 104. Mickey and Maggie at the beginning of the end. I remember tossing back and forth with their story, unwinding it in my head, one more detail to yank from the dream, how darkness teases Brooklyn, but never envelops. I know they are wed and resting still, a cemetery, a eulogy, assured that nothing truly dies in the end.
Did you know that a house can become fully engulfed in flames in as few as 5 minutes, but will usually take at least an hour or more to burn down completely? In cremation, it takes at least an hour for a body to burn. Does this mean that bodies are like houses? Or rather that arson is a time-sensitive act? We thank Mickey Rotz for these questions, and hope you enjoyed his disturbance.
Hello, it's me, your host, Genevieve Jagger. I will be acting as the sponsor of this episode of Inside the Coffin, as I have an important announcement to make. I'm about to launch my debut novel, Fragile Animals, into the world. Fragile Animals follows an ex-Catholic woman named Noelle, who runs away from her life to stay on the Scottish Isle of Bute. There, she meets a man who claims to be a vampire, and a relationship blooms between them based solely on confession. Fragile Animals is about heaven and hell, sex and religion, the way that trauma haunts us. It's about liaising with a vampire in order to get back at a god who has always despised you. The book will be released by 404 Inc. on April 25th, 2024, which is this Thursday at the time of posting this episode. Fragile Animals will be available in bookshops across the UK, where you can buy it digitally as an ebook. It will also be available in audiobook form, however you like to read. It would be my great honour if you would consider purchasing a copy of Fragile Animals. You can visit my website, jennajag.com, that's G-E-N-A-J-A-G.com, for further links and information, or else go directly to 404inc.com and order yourself a copy. All links will be available in the description of this podcast.
We want to know when you were born. Not for horoscopes or birthday presents. We don't even care how old you are in a legal or objective sense. When did you start? Is it the same time everyone else says you did? When you emerged? Do you remember emerging? Do you remember the beginning of your memory?
Juliet Escoria is the author of the novel Juliet the Maniac, the short story collection Black Cloud, and the poetry collection Witch Hunt. Her short story collection, You Are the Snake, is forthcoming from Soft Skull Press in 2024.
The following poem appeared originally in issue 5 of Witchcraft magazine. God Poem 3 by Juliet Escoria. If you want to speak to God, I recommend yelling, but follow up with a self-deprecating joke. Something about the way you were brought up, maybe the shape of your nose. I heard he likes altars, ones built from capitalism. Disposable plastic products, tampon applicators, old calculators, grocery bags, that kind of thing. For glue, use mucus. Any hole will do. Generally babies don't matter, but if he decides he wants one, make sure it is extra pink. Has all its fingers. Please rise for the eulogy of God Poem 3, read by Genevieve Jagger.
I wrote these poems in 2018, according to my hard drive. According to my email inbox, they were written shortly after I submitted the revisions for Juliet the Maniac. This is funny to find out, because I swore I wrote these during COVID. I tend to write poetry when I feel stuck with writing prose, and any time I've submitted a draft of a book, I've felt in a weird limbo where it's hard to write in paragraphs. Poetry feels like a verbal method of playing. I specifically wanted to write a series of poems about God because it seemed difficult. A difficult way to play.
We want to know when you're going to die. If it will be just one time, or if you're planning on doing it over and over and over again. Or if you have any interest in immortality. Do you think death involves a clear moment? Is it the moment your organs give up? Or the moment rigor mortis sets in and someone rolls your eyelids down like in a movie? Or when humanity ceases to remember your name? How many times have you been asked this? How many more times will you be asked this before death seems like the simplest way out of annoying philosophical discussions? I thought this was just going to be an audiobook podcast by a magazine. Not an interrogation of my inevitable decay.
We're sorry. We just can't stop thinking about it. How your body becomes more than it was in the process of decomposing. Leaked enzymes produce gases. The body bloats and doubles in size. Putrefaction.
Chelsea Lane Wells is a high school English and creative writing teacher and managing and fiction editor at Hypertext Magazine and Studios, who lives in the Oak Cliff area of Dallas, Texas. Her stories and essays have been published in Pank, Pithead Chapel, Split Lip, Paper Darts, Witchcraft, Little Fiction, Hobart, Lytro, Third Point Press, Evergreen Review, Heavy Feather, The Collapser, Wigleaf, and many others. A handmade, limited edition book containing her work was released by Larksparrow Press in 2016, and 11 of her stories have been nominated for Pushcart Prizes and Best of the Net Awards, with The Contents of Her Stomach winning Best of the Net 2015. Her first novel is forthcoming from Jaded Ibis Press in 2025. You can find out more about her at her website, www.chelseylanewells.com.
The following story originally appeared in issue 1 of Witchcraft magazine. Two Souls by Chelsea Lane Wells. She is more than a little bit cruel, it's known. When the fat girl who transferred from a school across town got a maxi pad smeared with strawberry jelly stuck to her locker, it was Summer who did it. When the teacher, falling apart about her divorce, came in to find a thrift store wedding dress in her classroom, it was Summer who did it. She was aloof and unimpressed with the aftermath of her meanness, and there was a fascinating randomness to it. For these reasons, people followed her. This wasn't why Austin was interested in her, though. He wasn't a disciple. He lived by choice in the high school outskirts. She caught his attention because she was confident in a way that most girls at their age weren't. So he put himself in her orbit, and before long, she noticed him. He discovered surprising things about her once they started to talk. Things that made him wonder if anyone she surrounded herself with actually talked to her or knew her at all. He learned that she was the child of a single father. Her mother died in a car wreck when she was a baby. She was drunk, Summer said bluntly, and Austin watched her. They were walking around the track in the back of the school. It was sunny, but not hot, and there was enough wind to lift her hair from the side of her face so he could see her expression clearly. She was frowning, but it looked more like disapproval than sadness. I don't drink. I don't want to be anything like her. Austin learned that she had missed almost her entire third grade year because she'd been in a hospital with a blood disorder. That her uncle had taught her to speak French, and that every day after school she went to the house of an elderly housebound neighbor and performed a series of small chores for no pay. Come with me, Summer said one day. They'd fallen into the habit of walking the track together directly after school, before she had to be at Walter's house. Austin kept his hands in his pockets,
kept himself completely neutral with Summer. He'd seen guys fall over backwards, struggling to impress her, without achieving the desired result. She clearly preferred a lighter touch. Austin suspected she needed to be in control. He was willing to concede this. "Okay," he said. He followed her off the school grounds, watching the way her dark hair fell in the sunlight, watching the taut backs of her thighs. Walter's house was a dilapidated two-story at the end of a block. She climbed the porch stairs and let herself in the front door without knocking. Austin closed the door behind himself and stood in the foyer. She disappeared into the house. Inside, it was dark, no lights on, cluttered with dense furniture and bookshelves crammed full along every wall. He heard an unreasonably loud television several rooms away and Summer's voice lilting over it. Then a deeper voice, Summer's footsteps coming towards him. Her head popped around a corner, and she crooked her finger at him. "Come," she said, a sweet little flip of her voice. Austin trailed her through a series of rooms until they reached a bedroom populated by a hospital bed, an armchair, a massive cabinet television at top volume. In the armchair was an old man, bent towards the television with his hand cupped around his ear. Austin stood awkward in the doorway. Summer leaned down into the old man's face and shouted, "Walter!" He looked up at Summer, then noticed Austin in the doorway and squinted at him. "This is my friend Austin," she shouted, pointing at him. "He's gonna stay here and watch TV with you while I get you your snack." Walter's gaze drifted back to the television without comment. Austin looked at Summer with his eyebrows raised slightly, and she smiled at him, the first purely genuine smile he'd gotten from her. As she passed him in the doorway, she took a fistful of his t-shirt and pressed her knuckles against his stomach and mouthed, "I'll be right back." Austin stood stiffly with one shoulder against the door jamb during her absence, trying to seem unobtrusive. Walter ignored him entirely. The room reverberated with commercial talk at obnoxious top speed and then an episode, Austin deduced, of MASH. Walter watched with his mouth open. Summer returned and handed Walter a bowl and spoon. "Applesauce," she said into his ear. "I'm going to show Austin around while I take care of things, and then I'm going to go, okay?" Walter seemed to nod slightly. He dipped the spoon into the bowl and began a shaky ascent, and Austin stepped into the hall. It seemed like nothing he wanted to see. Summer followed him out, so close she brushed full length along the side of him. Austin stole a glance at her face. All of this physical contact was entirely new. She pulled his hand from his pocket and said, "Come on." It was an upstairs room she took him to, at the front of the house, overlooking the street through a series of large curtainless windows. Sunlight slanted in at a steep angle. The walls were lined with glass front cabinets, and in the centre of the room was a table and a chair. "These are his collections," Summer said. "Look around." Austin walked the perimeter of the room, examining each cabinet. One was filled with daggers and swords, one with very old pistols, one with what looked like antique medical equipment, one with glass daguerreotypes and photographs. Austin leaned in to examine them and saw that some of them appeared to be of slaves on the auction block, others of lynchings, bodies on the side of the road. "Jesus," he said. "Scary, right?" she said. He reached a cabinet with an assortment of dolls and figurines and other small trinkets. When she spoke again, she was right behind him. "This one is my favourite," she whispered, and he turned to look at her. "What are they?" he asked. "They're supposedly objects that are cursed or haunted. They hold the souls, or parts of souls, of dead people, or some of them supposedly hold demons." "What the fuck?" Austin breathed. "Who is this guy?" Summer shrugged. She was standing so close he could smell her shampoo. "He used to tell me this stuff before the last stroke. We spent hours up here." "Creepy," Austin said, and turned towards her. She stayed where she was. Slowly, her hands rose and she took hold of the sides of his shirt. They stayed like that for a minute, still and silent, staring at each other. "Why do I like you so much?" Summer said then. Austin was watching her mouth. He couldn't help it. The curve of her bottom lip and the steepness of the divot in her top lip. He thought about that a lot. "I wasn't aware that you did," he murmured. She came up on her toes and kissed him, and he permitted himself one hand, just one hand. It slid along her waist and settled on her lower back, and though he willed it to be still, it pulled her a little tighter up against him of its own accord. "Don't you want to fuck me?" she whispered against his mouth, and Austin went dizzy. He made himself hesitate. He listened to the way she said it, spoiled and petulant, but also insecure. "Sure," he said, and she wanted to kiss him again. She strained towards him, but he kept his head cocked just far enough to elude her. His hand was still spread over the small of her back. "But I don't need to." "Congratulations," Summer said, and her hand went to his belt buckle. "That's the best response I've ever gotten. You get rewarded." She backed him up against the glass cabinet, filled with haunted dolls and heads and statues, and went down on her knees in front of him, and he let it happen without regret, because he felt he'd put in the time to have earned such an unexpected extravagance. "Will he hear this?" he asked impulsively at the last second. Summer pulled away from him slightly and said, "Did you not notice he's deaf as fuck, Austin?" When he was done, she stood and shook back her hair, and let him pull himself back together. Then she opened one of the doors to the cabinet he was leaning on, and he felt a rush of cold air as though from a refrigerator. It startled him, and he took a quick, involuntary step back. "What the hell?" he said. "Is it colder in there?" "Sure, Austin," she said. "To keep the ghosts fresh." He kept quiet. Surely that had been his imagination. He watched her hover her hand over the shelves, looking for something, and then she picked up a small head carved from ivory. She held it in front of his face between two fingers. Her other hand snaked up the front of his shirt, and she drew her nails down his chest, hard but absently. "This is an interesting one," she said. "Supposedly it holds the soul of his twin brother, who he killed." "Come on," Austin said. "You don't believe that." Summer shrugged. She held out the ivory head for him to take, and he cupped his hand reluctantly. She dropped it into his palm. Then she slid both hands under his shirt and found his nipples, and no girl had ever done that before. He'd never thought of his nipples as a sexually viable part of his body. But even with that head in his hand, weirdly heavy and ugly, seeming to stare at him through faded gold eyes, he was fully ready again. Fully. And now she had one hand on him, through his jeans, and his back was against the glass cabinet, and he wanted nothing more than to put down that ivory head so he could get both hands on her, but with the way he was positioned, he couldn't work it out. Her tongue was in his mouth. "Just drop it," he told himself. But immediately there was this thought, large in his mind. "Don't drop him." And that was bullshit, because this was all bullshit, and kind of starting to piss him off, actually. So he pulled his head away to say, "Take this thing," and in his mind he was already steering her towards the table and chair. He could do something with that, but as soon as they broke apart, she started talking. "Hours we would spend up here," she said. Her shirt had buttons, and she started to undo them, slowly, with one hand, the other hand still tight on him, and keeping him disoriented and still. Before the stroke, he was a lot more agile. He pushed me back and put his hands on my tits. "Fuck," Austin said. "I let him," Summer said. Her shirt was completely open. He could see the curve of her breast in one of those low-cut bras that went straight across so her breasts were like cupcakes. He'd had a girlfriend who wore one of these, and it was fucking murder on him. He lost his focus for a second, staring at her skin like cream. "I let him do what he wanted, and now I'm in his will. Patience pays off. You clearly understand that." She drew his hand holding the ivory head forward and pressed it to her breast, and he thought the head must hurt shoved against her like that, but her eyes rolled closed and she made a light sound. "I know how to put the souls in. How to catch them," she whispered. "Some tribe taught him when he was traveling in Africa. It's a chant. He made me memorize it." Her hand was moving purposefully against him, and it was working because for Christ's sake he was human, but there was a rising sick sensation in his gut, and his hand seemed unaccountably heavy, pressing that ivory head against her breast. In his mind, he still held a fleeting image of pulling down the cup of her bra and putting his mouth there, but it seemed increasingly clear nothing normal was going to happen here. "So I'm going to do it," she whispered, and her eyes opened, and she pressed against him with his hand trapped between their chests. "I'm going to put his soul in the head that holds his twin so they can be miserable together for eternity." "I'm poisoning him," she said, and smiled. And Austin saw the applesauce on its shaky way to the old man's mouth. "No, you're not," he said automatically. "Do Do you think you can stuff one object with two souls? She asked, and released his hand from her breast. She took the head from him, and even though he knew it was stupid and all this was fake, he felt a wash of relief to no longer be touching it. If it doesn't work, his soul might go into me, and then I'll carry his evil shit around forever. He'll probably make me touch myself. Okay, Austin said, and bent at the waist to dislodge her hand. I'm done. Summer's eyes went hard. She set the ivory head back on the shelf and said to it, low and conspiratorial, "See you soon," and closed the door. Then she rounded on Austin. Her shirt was still open. Evening was falling, so the light was low, but he could see the bare curve of nipple above one bra cup. "All done, Austin," she said, cocking her head. "Are you all done? You come in my mouth and I swallow you, and then I talk a little, and now you're all done." "You freak me out," he said. "I get it. It's weird and extreme. I get what you're doing, but that's enough, so I'm going to go." "God, you turned out to be a real disappointment," she said. "Gullible as hell. I thought you had a better backbone than that." "Thanks for showing me around," he said weakly, because you couldn't say thanks for sucking my dick, or at least he couldn't. On his way out, she said one last thing that he only fully computed once he was outside the house. "I bet you think I speak French, too." Almost immediately, Austin busied himself with another girl, ordinary in every way. A palate cleanser, completely different than Summer. Summer transferred schools to the girls' private academy. People talked about a pregnancy, an abortion, a suicide attempt, a brain tumor, a mental breakdown, a drug habit, all the most extreme possibilities. Austin tried not to hear it. He paid for his girlfriend on dates and took what he was offered and respected her boundaries. When he heard about the old man dying, he thought of Summer briefly, but forced her out of his mind. Then, that night, he woke up dry-mouthed and disoriented, and his hand that held the ivory head all those months ago was unaccountably heavy, and he had a hard-on so severe it felt like it would break off if he touched it. Austin put his head under his pillow like a kid, told himself it was bullshit, told himself he hadn't felt cold coming from that cabinet when she opened it, told himself it wasn't possible to trap a soul in an ivory head, told himself Summer was a fucked up chick and he was lucky to have gotten what he'd gotten from her before he walked. She was hot. It was a good blowjob. She swallowed and most girls didn't. Certainly not his girlfriend. Other typical male thoughts that calmed him down and made him feel secure. Still, he had that creeping feeling he wasn't alone in the room. The stuff of childhood nightmares. He refused to dignify it by looking. But it was a long time before he slept.
Please rise and begin to sob in honour of two souls.
So this is my eulogy for two souls. And I guess my eulogy for two souls should really be more of a eulogy for my brain, rip my brain, because when I went to look it up after Witchcraft Mag got in touch with me and asked me to do the eulogies for these two pieces of mine, I went to look it up and I have literally no memory of writing this story, no memory of the story really, but then I looked at the year that it was published and it was 2015. So that would have been 9 or 10 years ago. And at that time, I had this major uptick in productivity. And I was just churning stuff out and writing a lot and sending a lot of things out, you know, for submissions. So it makes sense that that story would have come from that time period and that I, you know, would have kind of left it behind because I was just writing so much that not every story that I wrote back then became a part of the regular collection that I put together, you know, to send out to presses and stuff. So yeah, this was a really nice surprise to have that story come back to my attention. And I'm really grateful to Witchcraft Mag for doing this revisit so that I could remember it. What's funny though, is that when I read it, I really had to read the whole thing to remember it. But once I had read the whole thing, I do remember the first immediate image that led to this entire story. And that's the image of her bra, like that cupcake bra, like that half bra where, you know, it's just like this straight line across and then the boob comes out over the top. That was my very first image. I wanted a girl who wore a bra like that and I wanted to know what she would do if she was really intense and like a little too much. So that's where she came from. So that's my eulogy for this story. And thanks so much to Witchcraft Mag, and I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you, Chelsea, and Juliet, and G, and August, and listener, and reader, and stranger.
The vibrations of this podcast have now wormed their way inside your brain and will lay eggs within your mind.
The process of hatching will be painful.
In most cases, fatal.
We leave you to face it alone, but have every confidence that you will be the one to deny death the satisfaction of a harvest.
As each episode of this podcast goes live, we will be re-releasing the past issues of Witchcraft Magazine in digital form. Issue 1 is now available to purchase at witchcraftmag.com. Issue 1 contained Two Souls by Chelsea Lane Wells, which you have just heard, as well as the works of many other talented spirits, some of whom you may hear in future episodes of this podcast.
Purchasing issues is the best way to support Witchcraft Magazine. Reading also gives you something to do while you wait to die.
We hope you survive to hear episode 2 of Inside the Coffin. Thank you.
I have been Satanic Hellspawn, Julia Fisher.
And I have been Primordial Underling, Genevieve Jagger.
As above,
so below.
We hope you live until tomorrow.